When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Let me run this by my lawyer is a really helpful phrase to have in your back pocket. Legal Shield has been giving legal peace of mind for over 50 years. They connect you to a vetted law firm in your state for an affordable monthly fee. Want an experienced set of eyes on a contract's fine print, or you finally want to get that will done? Legal Shield has a dedicated group of lawyers who have your back, no matter what the future brings. Sign up today at LegalShield.com/iHeart. PPLSI does not provide legal representation or advice. See a plan for complete terms.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for up to half the cost. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Savings based on cost of Consumer Cellular single line 1, 5, and 10 gig data plans with unlimited talk and text compared to lowest cost single line postpaid unlimited talk, text, and data plans offered by T-Mobile and Verizon January 2024.
Today, it's great to have Robert Sternberg on the podcast. Sternberg is a psychology professor at Cornell University. Among his major contributions to psychology are the Triarchic Theory of Intelligence and several influential theories relating to creativity, thinking styles, love, and hate. A review of General Psychology Survey ranks Sternberg as the 60th most cited psychologist of the 20th century, and he has authored or co-authored over 1,500 publications, including articles, book chapters, and books. And even that bio is a huge understatement of all that you've accomplished. Hey, Bob, so great to have you on the podcast today.
Delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for inspiring me to go into the field. So
my pleasure. What you've done.
It seems fair. Seems fair. No. Thank you. Thank you so much. That means a lot to me. In starting this conversation today, we could obviously talk about the research stuff, but I wanted to start more at your own childhood because I think I get a real kick out of every time I read that you created an intelligence test when you were in maybe even elementary school. Can you kind of tell me about that story?
Yeah, sure. When I was in elementary school, I didn't create it. I did poorly on IQ tests as a young kid in the late 50s, early 60s. They used to give IQ tests every year or two, group IQ tests, and I did very poorly on them. And you might ask how I know, since they didn't give us the scores, but when you get the test and you only finish one or two problems and everyone else has turned the page, it doesn't take a high IQ to realize that you bombed. So when I was in sixth grade, I was sent back to a fifth grade classroom to take an easier test that they thought would be more suitable to my ability level. And because it was a fifth grade classroom, I was less afraid and I think I did better. In seventh grade, I decided to try to figure out why I'd had so much trouble on IQ tests. So I did a project on development of the mental test, and I devised my own IQ test, the very famous Sternberg test of mental abilities, the STOMA, which I'm sure you've heard of, and it's so widely used all across the world.
Do you still have it?
No, it's long gone, along with everything else from when I was 13. Okay. And I also found the Stanford Binet Intelligence Test in the adult section of my town library and gave it to some of my classmates and didn't work out so well.
It didn't make you too popular. Did it?
Well, kids didn't mind it. The first one I tried was a girl in whom I was romantically interested, and it certainly proved to be an unsuccessful strategy for getting a girl romantically interested in me. And then the head school system psychologist got wind of it and called me down from social studies class and bawled me out for 15 minutes, threatening he'd burn the book if I ever brought it into school again.
Really?
Popular with it. Yeah.
Oh my
yeah.
gosh.
So that was, you know, for a teenager, you never do that. You never tell a teenager you can't do something because that makes it really attractive. So I'm still doing studying IQ and intelligence and things like that. Not just to show him, of course, but because that's what I became really passionate about.
Yeah, I know. And when did you start becoming passionate about studying it scientifically? Because when you were in grad school in psychology, that wasn't the topic of your dissertation, was it? Was the competential theory part of your dissertation?
Well, it actually was. It was my
That was your dissertation. Okay.
That's where I first proposed the theory. I started off studying a very exciting topic in graduate school. I mean, you know, you might have to hold on to your chair because it's so exciting. It was negative transfer in part Hall and Hall, part free recall, which was just a mind-bendingly great thing to study. But after I did that for a year and tried to stay awake, I knew that wasn't what I wanted to do. And at the end of my first year, my undergraduate advisor, a guy named Daniel Tolvin, came around and invited me to meet some people at the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences. And I told them I want to study intelligence, but I don't know how I want to study it. And they looked at me like, well, it's really sad when a guy who's like 22 years old has already run out of ideas. But that summer after my first year, I figured out how I was going to study intelligence, and that did become my dissertation. Some people would say, oh, you know, that was the best work he ever did, and it's been downhill ever since then.
I don't think anyone would say that. But, do you remember the moment then when you decided you wanted to actually scientifically study intelligence? Like, who were you reading in grad school along those lines? Were you reading like Charles Spearman? Like, you know, because there wasn't, like, Howard Gardner hadn't even had his theory yet, right? At that point.
No, I started studying intelligence after my seventh grade project. I did a project in 10th grade on the effects of distractions on mental ability test performance. And I had people take mental ability tests that I created, and they either were in the control condition where they just took it, or they had a car headlamp shining in their eyes in a dark room, or they listened to a metronome ticking, or they had the Beatles in the background playing She's Got the Devil in Her Heart and Please Mr. Postman. And the only effect I got was that people did better listening to the Beatles music. And then in 11th grade, I took physics when I was 17, I guess, and it started off okay, but every marking period, my grade was going down. So I tried to salvage my physics grade, and I did a physics aptitude test, which was actually pretty good. The high school later adopted it, and it predicted physics grades with a validity coefficient of 64. So I did that. And then even in college, I just wasn't that I did a lot of reading. It's just I always study things I'm bad at, you know, and so that's a lot of things. So I study a lot of things and study intelligence because I seem to have problems with it.
That's so interesting. I mean, it just feels like you were like destined to study this topic, and it showed up so early, these themes.
Well, you too.
I feel that way too.
So we both ended up doing some of the same stuff. You know, you had this ungifted issue. So with me, it wasn't ungifted. It was like total loser. And that's how I got interested.
So interesting. So you're in college. You're at Yale undergraduate. Is that right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you, did you know that you wanted to major in psychology like your freshman year? What were you like freshman year of college? What was Bob Sternberg like freshman year of college?
Yeah. Well, I got there and I definitely wanted to major in psychology. That didn't go so well either. I took intro psych, and the first test was graded on a 10-point scale. And the professor handed out our papers. It was the first hand that right before Thanksgiving vacation, he handed them out in descending order. So it was a 10-point quiz, and he started handing out the 10s and then the 9s and then the 8s. And then when you got your paper, you could leave for Thanksgiving vacation, and he did the 7s. When he got to the 6s, I figured, well, he must have gotten mine out of order because there's no way I could have gotten below a 6. And he actually got to me, and I had a 3 at the top of my paper, 3 out of 10. And he commented, you know, there's a famous Sternberg in psychology, and it looks like there won't be another one. I still remember. I have a photographic memory of his saying that. So I figured, well, that doesn't look so good for my psychology career. So I decided to switch to math. And then I took a course on real analysis. And I still remember, you know, thinking I'm going to be a math major. And the real analysis course was really hard. And we took a midterm. And I had no idea where the problems came from. And I got a 35 on that. And I figured, well, that was just because it was such a hard test. And there was this really scruffy, stupid-looking guy sitting in front of me. I figure, well, you know, he must have done worse than I did. So I looked over at his paper, and he got a 98. And I realized, well, it looks like I'm not going to be majoring in math either. So I went back to psychology, and that's what I've done since then.
Now, when you got your professorship at Yale and you started to get acclaim, did you ever go back to that teacher? Like, were you a professor at Yale at the same time that he was still teaching?
Oh, yeah. He was the head of the search committee that hired me.
No, seriously? Seriously? That's crazy.
Yeah, I took another class from him as a junior, and I got an A in that. And he and I actually became, I think, pretty good friends. He later got sick and when I was at Yale as a professor, and I went to visit him until he passed away, but he was a good guy. It's just that, you know, that I didn't, his intro course, I got a C in it, and he told me, well, he gave it to me as a gift, but things got better with him. He was good.
Who was it? What was his name?
Bob Crowder.
Oh, Bob, of course. Yeah. I didn't know if you had one of those, like, how do you like them apples moments, you know, from like Good Will Hunting. So that's why I asked if you ever went back to him and were like, you know, yeah, look at me now.
We got along just fine. That's great. I really admired him, and we became pretty good friends too.
That's great. Okay. So let's get into some of the meat and potatoes here. One question I have is, you know, what do you see as the, what is the relationship between the componential theory and the triarchic theory? Like, at what point did one morph into the other?
Well, I started off with what I called the componential theory. And what I was doing starting in grad school is I'd take a problem from an IQ test. Like, I started with analogies. Then what I'd do is I'd time you as you solve the analogies, and I'd decompose the reaction times into the underlying processes that you use to solve them. So, for example, in an analogy, you have to encode the terms, and then you have to infer the relation between A and B, and then you have to apply it to C. And I did that because I thought that, you know, the problem with a lot of the items on IQ tests is they don't measure what they're supposed to measure. Yeah. So, for example, a verbal analogy, which is very common, like, you know, you'd see this, say, on the Miller analogies test, like mitigate is to assuage is exacerbate is to what? Well, that's supposed to measure verbal reasoning, but it's pretty much a straight vocabulary test. And the idea was that there were people who were really smart, but it would look like they're not because they didn't have the opportunities to gain the vocabulary or the math skills or whatever. So that's what I started doing. And the research worked out pretty well in terms of what I was looking for. But as time went on, I realized there was something wrong with it. And that's been my whole career. I mean, my whole career is coming up with theory and then realizing there's something wrong with it. And then I come up with a better, what I hope is a better theory. And what was wrong with that, I came to know, was that it was all based on IQ tests. So although it was process models of IQ tests, it was still IQ tests. And then what happened is when I was director of graduate studies in psychology at Yale, there were some students who applied to our program, one of whom I have referred to as Alice, who was very smart confidentially or analytically or high G or high IQ, you know, just real test smart. I mean, she had really high scores in tests. But when it came to coming up with her own ideas, she wasn't so great. And then I had another student who I've called Barbara, who actually, when she applied, didn't get in because she was, her grades were okay, but her test scores were terrible. And even though she got great letters of recommendation, no one beside me wanted to admit her. So I actually hired her and had her as a research associate for a couple of years, and then she got in as the top pick. But she was really creative. It just didn't come out in GREs and SATs and ACTs. And, you know, I mean, those tests don't measure creativity. If you're very creative in taking those tests, well, you're screwed. You know, you can't, you just supposed to pick A, B, C, D, or E. And then there was a third student who I called Celia, who wasn't as good analytically as Alice and wasn't as good creatively as Barbara. But when she went on the job market, she wasn't the greatest grad student in the whole world, but she got every job she applied for. So she knew how to do a job interview. I could say that. I mean, I never got every job I applied for. So what I came to realize is that I realized the mistake I was making, and the mistake was that the reliance on IQ tests, that the, you know, Barbara was creatively intelligent and Celia was practically intelligent, but the IQ tests were only looking at Alice smarts, which is how analytically smart you are. And so I expanded the theory to include creative and practical smarts as well as analytical smarts. I think the problem in the field of intelligence is that it never kind of moved beyond 1904, which is when Spearman wrote his first famous paper on general intelligence objectively determined and measured. And, you know, now it's, I think it's 2021 or something like that. I may have the year wrong, but that's a long time, you know, like that's over a century. And we're still doing 1904 stuff. And so I think that it's not that general intelligence and IQ don't matter. It's that there's more to intelligence than just that. And somehow we got stuck in this very academic notion of intelligence. So I expanded it to include these other things. But the thing I would emphasize is that in science, I've tried not to do what the field of intelligence has done. I mean, you know, these theories are all wrong. I mean, you know, eventually you hope you get closer to the truth, but it has to be a process where you say, look, you know, we've had this theory for a while. Is it really perfect or is there more we can do? And so that's when I came up with the triarchic theory, which eventually itself was replaced.
What year was the triarchic theory? Like what, around what time was that created?
Let's see, it was 1765. I started, my dissertation was published in 1977. Okay. And the first big paper on the triarchic theory was in 1984. And then my book was 1985, Beyond IQ.
So amazing. So you're working this completely independently of Howard Gardner's theory of multiple intelligence. His book comes out, Frames of Mind comes out in 1984.
'70s.
Yeah. So his book comes out and you look at his book and like, what do you think of it? How does it relate to your multiple intelligences theory? I mean, I know the answers, but I want our listeners to know.
Yeah. Oh, good. You know the answer. Maybe you can tell me. So my original impression was the same as that of many people in the field. And that is that they were competing modern theories, that they were sort of based, as I've put it, on a different metaphor of mind. And that is that these were more systems theories rather than just there's this psychometric factor, this kind of geographic thing, then it's over here in this factor. Today, I would say that we dealt with different aspects of intelligence. he was dealing with different domains, you know, the linguistic domain, the quantitative domain, the spatial domain, the musical domain. And at that point, I was dealing with processes. And I actually just published recently a paper on musical intelligence where I showed that you could actually cross his domains with the processes in my theory. He and I do disagree on some things, like some of his intelligences I probably wouldn't see as intelligences, and he probably has some problems with my theory. But I think what we were both trying to do in different ways is to expand the way people look at intelligence. I think that was a common goal.
I mean, it seemed like something was in the air then, you know, the Michael Jackson era, like you know, there was something in that air then about, you know, it's time to go beyond standard metrics of intelligence. I'm not relating that to Michael Jackson at all, but I'm just saying, I'm thinking about that time frame, 84.
I started working on this in the early 80s, and then he picked it up too. But a lot of people, you know, the times then became more conservative, I think, and a lot of people in the field went back to, I think it's really a mistake. And the reason I think it's really a mistake is you can see in the world today what G has bought us. If I can change the topic just a little.
Can you tell people what G is? I mean, our audience might not know.
General intelligence, right. It's what, you know, it's a large portion of what you get out of an IQ test. You get a few other things out of an IQ test, but it's kind of related to what you measure. And the problem is that during the 20th century, general intelligence actually went up. I mean, you know, the slightly broader thing, IQs, went up 30 points. It wasn't all G. It was a lot of other things too. But IQs went up 30 points in the 20th century, which is the so-called Flynn effect. And the only reason that average IQ didn't go up to 130 is the test publishers kept renorming the test to make the average 100. So an IQ of 100 in 2000 meant a very different thing from what it meant in 1900. An IQ of 100 in 2000 would have been about 130 in 1900. Incredible difference. And what bothers me about our fixation on IQ is that if you look at the problems we face in the world today, wow, IQ sure isn't solving them. I mean, you know, like we've got so many different kinds of problems in the world. And we have these high IQ people who go to prestigious colleges and universities and get very impressive degrees. And then when it comes to solving real world problems, they make a mess of them. So I really wish that the field would broaden their consideration of what intelligence is, because, you know, high IQ people are good at solving multiple choice problems and that are very well structured. You know, they have a beginning, a middle, an end. You read the problem. It contains all the information you need. The information is valid. It's not emotionally arousing. It has no real world consequences. It's just kind of like this very academic thing. And that's so different from solving problems in the real world. And we know that in problem solving, the fact that you're good at one kind of problem doesn't mean you're good at solving another kind of problem. I mean, some people are good at work and they're terrible in their personal relationships. And some people are good in their personal relationships and they're terrible at work. And so we're asking for a level of generalization from IQ tests and ACTs and SATs and GREs and MCATs and so on that just doesn't exist. So we're picking the wrong people a lot of time, and we're getting people who are good as long as you give them five choices and an emotionally unarousing problem with no real world consequences, but they're not necessarily people who are good at solving real problems.
What do you make of like Linda Gofferson's argument? She would disagree with that statement, right? She would say that that general intelligence shows a lot of strong correlations in everyday life, especially in the workplace, that the correlations are actually very strong. How do you respond to that?
Well, there are a few things. One is I've never been someone who said that IQ is worthless. I know Some people do. I'm not one of them. In fact, IQ tests mostly measure knowledge and analytical reasoning skills. And that's part of my own theory. So I am not anti-IQ tests. My problem is that that's not all there is to intelligence. That's part of it. But it's not the whole thing. So you would expect IQ to show some correlation with lots of things in life because you need to do analytical reasoning in your life. So I don't have any disagreement with that. In terms of fairly strong correlations, I don't know if you'd say they're strong. A lot of the correlations you read about in the literature are corrected, which means that they're raised to account for unreliability of a test and restriction of range of a test and whatever else. So they're not the original correlation. Some people would say those are better, but they're not the actual correlations you get from the test. But the fact that there's a correlation of IQ with a lot of things, I don't find surprising, and it's not contrary to my theory. To the extent I have a complaint, it's that, the you know, if you get a correlation, say, of 0.4, you know, as you sometimes do, that seems like a fairly typical median correlation. You're talking about accounting for 16% of the variance in the criterion. So if you're predicting, I don't know, income, or you're predicting grades in school, or you're predicting how quickly you graduate. So one problem is you're accounting for 16% of the variance. That still leaves 84% left. That's not real high. There's a second problem, which is a bigger problem. And the bigger problem is that the correlations don't take into account that the fact that you did well on these tests gave you opportunities to succeed so that the correlation would go up. Let me explain what I mean. This is important. Let's say we selected people in our society to go to college, not on the basis of SATs and grades. I mean, you know, those are so subjective, but on something really objective, height. Because that you can measure objectively. Everyone agrees, you know, you can take a tape measure. You don't have to argue about what test you use. So now to get into Harvard, you have to be 6'5", 6 feet, 5 inches tall. Get into Yale, maybe 6'4". To get into Dipsy Doodle State, maybe you have to be, you know, 3'7". Everything's done now on the basis of height because it's so objective. So the guys and gals who go to the great schools are very tall. The ones who go to the crummy schools are very short. And then to get into grad school and law school and medical school and business school, you have to be even taller, at least if you want to go to a prestigious school. So this goes on for years. And then over time, you notice that the people who are succeeding are very tall. And then you do a correlational study, and what do you find? You find that there is a high correlation or moderate correlation between your height and your getting into, you know, prestigious jobs and prestigious colleges, and you're having, you know, more money. And you say, well, this proves that height is causal of success. No, what it proves is that you actually societally created the correlation. So part of the correlation that we're told is so impressive is because society gives more opportunities to people who do better on these tests. And it's not, you know, it can be test scores, it can be religion. In some societies, all the people who succeed are a certain religion and the others marginalized. It can be skin color. It can be your whether you're male or female in many opportunities. I mean, look at, I used to be president of the American Psychological Association. If you look at the early years, it was almost all men. And you could say, well, that proves that being male makes you more skin. Well, women didn't have the chance. So the correlations don't mean as much as they seem to.
Very interesting thought experiment. And it makes me think of like the Lubinsky and Benbow findings, you know, where they say like, see, you know, those with high SAT scores at age 12, look, they're getting patents. They're so creative as adults, et cetera, et cetera. So see, this proves that giftedness at a young age predicts later thing. I think that a lot of that research is interesting and important, but I've, you know, had the criticism, which I think you, this is dovetails with what you're saying, is that where's the control group in that? So this begs the, right, that's the question. Yeah. So this begs the question for you. Can you tell us about this groundbreaking work you did at colleges where you brought in a control, where you expanded our metrics of intelligence and you asked the question, well, what would happen if we measured for creative and practical in addition to analytical? Would we get crap students, you know, or would we get even better students or just the same kind of students? So can you tell us about your findings?
Sure. I just want to say, with regard to the kind of work that Lubinsky and Benbow and to some extent Godfredson do, I don't question their findings. But if you're identified in a talent search and you're given a lot of extra resources in the talent search, and then you, as a result of that, partially as a result of that, you have all these additional opportunities and you go to a better school and then you have an advisor who's more connected, who can get you into a better grad school. I mean, you know, to some extent, I'm not saying totally, we create those correlations and then we say, voila, look, this is nature. It's not nature. It's the same with the tall thing. It would be the same if we did it by religion. You know, honestly, if we decided there are some people in the society who would rather only give opportunities to members of certain religious groups. We all know that. And in some countries, they do that. And what a coincidence it is that in those countries, all the top people are of those religions. It's the same with race. If you were black in the 1860s, 1850s, it didn't matter what your IQ was. You know, you're going to end up probably, if you're in the South, on a plantation. It didn't get you out of being a slave on the plantation. So we just have to, look at how the environment affects the correlation. Okay, in terms of what we did at colleges. So I was at Yale as a professor for 30 years, and it was a good run. And we did a project that was funded by a testing company, and it was called the Rainbow Project, and it was a national project where we had high school and college students all over the country, some of them in very selective schools, some in not so collective schools, and we gave them these tests of analytical abilities, which are like ACTs or SATs, but also creative and practical abilities. And we collected the data. It had many collaborators. And what we found...
Hey, I was one of the collaborators, summer 2001, 2001. Oh, yeah. I was your intern in college.
Thank you for being there when I needed you. I really appreciate that. And so we get the results. And the results were that if you add the creative and practical test to the analytical test, you could more than double the prediction, just the first year college grades, not even looking at broader things, just straight GPA. In other words, even for straight GPA, adding creative and practical tests mattered. And not only did you more than double prediction in terms of percentage of variance accounted for, you also substantially decreased ethnic and socially defined racial group differences. So that was a great finding, because usually you don't get that. You don't usually get this kind of increase in prediction together with a decrease in racial ethnic group differences. And what that suggested is that the students of diverse socially defined racial and ethnic groups brought to the table different skills that were performance relevant, but that the traditional tests weren't measuring. So when we got those results, they were published as the lead article in what I think is the top journal in the field, and they got some publicity. It looked really good. And then I should have known this, but I didn't see it coming. The organization, the testing organization that was funding us, cut off all our funding. And, you know, I don't know why I didn't see it coming. Other people had told me, you know, you better watch out. And it's all, I think, I mean, you know, this is only my opinion, but it's a little like drug companies. If your results support their drugs, they give you more funding. If the results don't support their drugs, good luck to you. Or food companies, if your results say how healthy, you know, rotten chips are for you, then they keep funding you. And if they show that rotten chips cause health decreases, your funding is gone. So now they, of course, had a different interpretation. They said that our tests couldn't be upscaled, used on larger samples. So at that point, I was in a career crisis because during my years at Stanford as a grad student and Yale as a faculty member, I always saw myself as a faculty member. I mean, I never imagined doing anything else. And now I felt that I'd reached a dead end. No commercial company for testing was going to touch me because these results were not what they wanted to find, or at least that's the way it looked. So I made this decision to do a career change and go into administration. And I went to Tufts as Dean of Arts and Sciences. And we started a project called the Kaleidoscope Project, which was not just, you know, like low stakes, let's do this project and see what happens. It was used for admissions for arts and sciences and engineering at the undergrad level. So all students applying to Tufts for undergraduate had the option, it wasn't required, of doing essays in that were motivated by what had become my theory of successful intelligence, which also included wisdom. So it had creative, analytical, practical-based, and wisdom-based abilities, the idea being that you need creative skills to come up with ideas. You need analytical skills to say if they're good ideas. You need practical skills to be able to apply your ideas and to sell them to other people who don't like them. And you need wisdom-based skills to ensure that they help achieve some kind of common good. Nice. And so I spent a year sort of trying to pave the way to do this project. I had a great collaborator in the Dean of Undergrad Admissions, whose name was Kaufman. No, not Kaufman. It was Lee Kaufman, but it was close to Kaufman. I just had to say that. It was Kaufman. I mean, maybe there's something about that cough part. Anyway,
James Kaufman was another student of yours. So yes, the Kaufmans love you. They love you. Yeah.
I know. Oh, I just, and I was just reading a paper by Alan Kaufman this morning. Yeah. So it just seems to be the right name to, I mean, just imagine the heights I could have reached if my last name were Kaufman. And instead Sternberg. And so I've been so limited by my, I wonder if I could still change my last name. Anyway. So we use these items, and they were not multiple choice at all. They were performance-based. So they measure creative, analytical, practical, and wisdom-based. So a creative item might be something like, you know, write a short story such as the End of MTV or The Mysterious Lab or The Professor Disappeared. Or suppose that the Nazis had won World War II, what would the world be like today? Or you could have analytical questions like to analyze your favorite book, or you could have practical questions like solving a world problem, or how could you convince a friend of an idea that she or he didn't initially believe in? And then we had wisdom-based problems, which might be something like, you know, how could you later in your life help make the world a better place? And we found again that we were able to expand the horizon to increase prediction and decrease quite substantially ethnic and socially defined racial group differences. And so during the time I was dean there, we continued with this project. It was always optional, and it resulted in students being admitted to Tufts who otherwise wouldn't have been admitted. And so the idea was that, you know, if you had a great record, fine. If you had a terrible record, you probably won't get in. But if you were kind of in the middle, showing that you excelled in creative or practical or wisdom-based skills, could make a difference. And then I published a book called College Admissions for the 21st Century, published by Harvard, that was based on this work. And then I went to Oklahoma State as provost and senior vice president, and we did a project there, and that was called Panorama. And we got really great results there too, in changing the admissions procedures. So what we showed, and contrary to what our testing organization had said, we were able to upscale to very large numbers, eventually tens of thousands of people were able to upscale, and it changed who we admitted, and the people were successful. And the idea was that if colleges say, as I believe they should, that they want people who are going to make the world a better place, you're not going to find that out by looking at kids' SAT scores. I mean, that is so not the way to find out who's going to make the world a better place. And what we are trying to do is introduce admissions devices that would address that question.
It seems like the difference, that what makes you unique in this space, is that you're still into testing though, and it's a subtle difference, because so many people right now are talking about it's SAT optional, and they're all for it. They're saying down with the system, down. But your tests are still tests. I mean, you're creative and practical. I mean, they expand the realm of what we're testing, but it doesn't sound like you're saying down with testing. Am I right?
Yeah, that's true. My argument has been that we should expand testing, and I'll tell you why. The the people who started with testing, you know, in the early 20th century, people like Henry Chauncey and Lindquist and Conan, they actually had a good goal. And the goal was the recognition that if you don't use tests, you risk creating a hierarchy based on things that maybe you don't want to create a hierarchy based on, like how much money your parents have or what color your skin is or what, you know, who your social group is. So the idea of testing was to go beyond that. The problem that they didn't recognize, and probably couldn't have recognized, is that test scores on their tests would be fairly substantially correlated with the old stuff. That parents who were higher SES, socioeconomic status, could afford more opportunities for their kids. They lived in better school districts often, so the kids went to better schools. They could buy them test preparation books. They could buy them courses. They could buy them tutors. They could give them stuff to do at home because they were better educated. I came from an uneducated home, pretty much. Neither of my parents graduated from high school. And so, you know, I know what it's like. You know, your parents don't do this kind of test preparation for you. They wouldn't even know what to do. At least mine didn't. And so what happened is that the traditional test, to some extent, ended up laundering socioeconomic status. It's sort of like, you know, laundering money, except it was SES. So now you've created this meritocracy that's supposed to be based on mental ability, but to a large extent, not totally, but to a large extent is based on social opportunities. And then you get, honestly, people in the testing field who mostly came from upper middle or middle socioeconomic statuses who keep perpetuating the system. And, you know, I mean, we all want the best for our kids, and the people in any society who are in power want the next generation of powerful people with high opportunities to be kind of like them, because that's what their kids are going to be. So my argument has been that, yeah, we do want to create a system where people have opportunities based on their abilities and talents, but that the abilities and talents we've measured are too friggin' narrow. And the risk of getting rid of tests is that we'll start paying too much attention to, did you go to a prestigious school? Do you have a, you know, college counselor create a list of extracurricular activities and so on, instead of looking at the kids' potentials. But if we're going to look at potentials, we always should have looked at broader potentials, not just narrow ones.
And you think that psychometrics is important in this process? Like, we testing is still valuable.
The kind of testing we do, it doesn't look anything like the kind of testing that's traditionally been. Because if you mean by testing giving kids trivial, inconsequential, unemotionally arousing, artificial academic problems, what we do, I don't think has much to do with that. I just published recently, I think you saw it, an article in The New Scientist
that adaptive shows example
of our kinds of test items. But our kinds of test, in our test, we might, for example, have two countries that are competing for a water resource. Like, one is upstream on a river and the other is downstream. And the one that's downstream on the river is claiming that the upstream one is taking too much of the water and leaving them with desert conditions. And the two countries are ready to go to war. And so you might be asked, how would you resolve a problem like that? How could you create a system to resolve it? Or you might get a problem where two friends of yours break up and they both text you and they want to talk to you, and you know that they're both going to tell you that you should take their side. And you don't really want to take sides, but you do want to stay friends. So how would you negotiate that? Or, I gave an example of a future history of what would have happened if the Nazis won World War II, or what would have happened if the Americans lost the American Revolution, or whatever. But our tests are very different from, say, they're like tests of creativity are graded by rubrics for how novel and useful the responses are. Tests of wisdom are graded for the extent to which your answer helps to promote a common good by balancing your own, others, and larger interests over the long and short terms through the use of positive ethical values. So we do assess. But I think for things that matter in life, not stuff that's easy to assess just because it's cheap and easy to assess.
Yeah, fair enough. I do have to ask, though, who creates these test items? I mean, are you good at practical intelligence? Like, are you like, it's almost like the person who I wouldn't be surprised at. I mean, I'm not questioning and saying it doesn't, it seems like you're not. That's not my point. But I'm saying, the test constructors themselves, there's kind of an interesting thing where you kind of have this like assumption that like, well, how do you even know the answers to the questions,
Yeah. So in terms of, am I good at practical intelligence? Yeah. I was describing my practical intelligence work to a senior professor at Yale shortly after I got tenure there. His name was Wendell Garner. And he interrupted me to say, you should know, Bob, that you got tenure here not because of your practical intelligence, but despite it. So I don't think I'm a model of practical intelligence. But in terms of who creates the
items. Yeah, who creates it?
When I have created some, staff have created some. The problem is not so much, I think, creating items. It's how do you score them? And so what we do is we create rubrics for what we're looking for, and we go through a fairly elaborate training process for raters. So at Tufts, that would have been for admissions officers. At Yale, it was for staff we hired for the center I ran. But we teach them what what does it mean to be creative or analytical or practical. We then have them practice on actual essays individually, and then they get together as a group and they compare answers until we can get high inter-rater reliability. And some of the raters we have to let go because they either can't achieve reliability or they can't kind of get the idea of what we're looking for. Now, you might say, well, the advantage of multiple choice tests is they have right and wrong answers. But my argument would be that there are very few serious problems in life that have just the right and the wrong answer. If you look at how should we how should we divide COVID-19 resources, you know, resources for vaccines or resources for testing? Or how can we deal with the fact that global warming is out of control? Mm. Or how can we deal with increasing income disparities? Those are the real problems the world faces. Or what can I do when my kid is not, I'm pretty sure he's not telling me what he's really doing when he goes out at night. And those are the problems we really face in life. They don't have A, B, C, D, E answers. They're high stakes. They're emotionally involving. They're unstructured problems. Often it's hard to figure out what the problem is. What we try to do is create problems that are like the problems we really face in life. And the reason that's important is you can get people who are very good at solving these highly structured academic problems, and that's what they're good at. You know, they join Mensa or, you know, they go to a good school. And the emphasis I've put in my most recent work on adaptive intelligence, which is like about the fifth iteration of theories of intelligence, is that intelligence has always been defined as the ability to adapt to the environment. It's like, you know, how well can you get along, not on a standardized test, but in dealing with the world. And species that don't adapt disappear, right? I mean, like, they're gone. And somehow that got lost in the intelligence business, that what we need is people who say, let's take the real challenges the world faces. Like, look at the mess we made with COVID-19. I mean, you know, with all these 30 IQ points, the European Union still can't get the vaccine thing straight. And the United States for about a year there was totally at sea. And income disparities are totally like crazy out of hand. And so what's happened is people are, you know, IQ isn't about doing something that helps the world. It's about, honestly, it's about doing something that helps yourself. And we have an awful lot of politicians who went to very prestigious schools. And all they seem to care about is themselves and getting reelected and how can they make more money. And it's not just in the United States. I mean, across the world, we're seeing an increase in authoritarian leadership of authoritarians and people who want to be authoritarians. Some succeed, some don't. And once you get one of those in power long enough, it tends to be a one-way street. And it's pretty clear that IQ isn't helping very much. Some of the smart IQ people are the ones who are most contributing to it because they can profit from it. So my argument is we need a notion of intelligence that makes the world a better place, that somehow chooses people who are going to make a positive, meaningful, and potentially enduring difference to the world, not people who are going to go into Congress and like it's one scandal after another, whatever their IQ may be. Mm. And I'm not talking about scandals just of sexual behavior. I'm talking about scandals where there's only one person they're looking out for. They're not representing a constituency other than themselves.
So cool. It's so cool. I love that you're this idea of emphasizing that intelligence is not just about the individual. It's actually pretty novel. it shouldn't be, but it is.
In my book, Adaptive Intelligence, which just came out, what I point out is that we need to think of intelligence collectively because we're at risk. Mm. If global warming continues the way it has been, there'll come a time when, you know, our IQs may continue to go up. We may have sky-high IQs, but we won't be here. The only ones that are going to be here are the bacteria, the viruses, the cockroaches. And if someday beings from some other planet come here and they discover bacteria, viruses, and cockroaches and the pathetic remains of human civilization, are they going to commend human civilization for being so at the top of some kind of love, joy, great chain of being when it's the only species that in record time managed to destroy itself? That's us. And yeah, if that's smart, then I don't know what stupid is.
Well, that's a great quote. That's a great quote right there. Maybe I'll put that at the top of the show notes, that quote right there. make a note of that. Okay. 52. Okay. Yeah. So how does this relate to, because I see a link here between that line of research and then your work on heat. I mean, there's so much heat in the world today, right? How can we apply our intelligence to transcend heat and have more love in the world?
Yeah, well, that is a different line of research, but it is related.
It's not that different.
And where it's related, when I've been asked, how do you combat hate? I've said there are, you know, three things you really can do. One is just have people really get to know each other. You know, often the people we hate are people we don't even know at all. You know, like there are people who hate Jews who have never met a Jew. There are people who hate Muslims who have never met a Muslim. I mean, it's, you know, so just really engaging with people. A second solution is wisdom, which is if you take seriously the notion of a common good, you can't just say it's about me and people like me, my tribe. You can't do what the Nazis did in World War II or some people are doing today and saying it's just people of my skin color or my religion or the religion I claim I have or people who live in my part of the country or my community. Common good means how are you helping other people beside yourself? Because the kind of situation we have in the United States is utterly untenable, where they're just, it's become two countries. And that's smart. I mean, like, you know, having two groups of people at war with each other, that's what high IQ has brought. So I think the second solution is wisdom. And the third, as you pointed out, is love. As you know, my wife Karen and I actually have a website, lovemultiverse.com, which is all about love. That's something I study. And the idea of love is that, and it comes, you know, for us, it comes out of science, but for other people, it may come out of religious beliefs, that if you take love seriously, then you realize that, you know, the only person hate destroys is yourself in the end, that haters are, you know, eating away at themselves. And that if you take on the notion that instead of trying to destroy others, if we all believe that a rising tide raises all ships, if we all try to embrace each other instead of stab each other in the back, we not only wouldn't have to deal with hate, we'd have so much of a better world.
Ain't that the truth? I remember my first year in grad school, Karen, who's now your wife, but I remember she was working on the theory of hate around that time. I think she came from Germany because she was interested in working on the hate work, if I remember correctly. Yeah.
And she did her dissertation on hate, and we later published the book on hate and an edited book on hate. But I think that this further shows the bankruptcy of our current notion of intelligence, that, you know, as the world has become smarter, it's also, we have growing authoritarianism. We have greater, you know, I've never seen the country at odds like it is today. I mean, this is like getting close to civil war times, and people are using their IQs to foment dissension and hatred. And unfortunately, social media companies have been mostly focused on profit, and negative posts get spread around more. They're more diffused.
Yeah.
And so what's happening is that our intelligence is actually working against us. It's, you know, through social media. I mean, you know, very smart people put that together to maximize the profits of the social media company, but it sure as hell isn't helping civilization as we know it. So we have to start getting wise. We have to be more creative. And we have to realize the importance of love instead of hate.
Amen. Amen. I love what you're doing. And I'm so glad that you expanded your research to this realm. It's so important. But I have to ask a cheeky question, though. Why do so many of your theories have three components to it? Do you have three reasons for that?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, it has gotten ridiculous. I mean, like, not only do I have three Reese's, I have triplets. I mean, like, this is really insane.
There's something about you and the number three.
I did not choose to have triplets. That just kind of happened. Actually, though, that's less true in current times. The theory of adaptive intelligence, the new Cambridge University Press book, isn't really about it. If it has elements, it has creativity, analytical skills, practical skills, and wisdom. It has four. But I think that the important thing isn't the number,
of course,
but rather that what we need to be doing is, as I said, focusing on whether it's through love or wisdom or adaptive intelligence, we need to be focusing on making the world a better place. And we're not doing that. And we have a lot of people in the country today seem more intent on developing aggression and grudges. And whether you're regardless of what you're studying, that doesn't hold up a good future for humanity or for other species too. We're also killing off other species. So I think that, you know, adaptation in a broad sense isn't just about changing yourself to fit the world. It's also about changing the world to be a better place. It's about shaping the world.
Beautiful.
And we're running out of time to shape the world. I mean, you know, at some point, global warming will be so out of control that there's nothing we can do about it. And the income disparities, at some point when people feel totally ripped off, you begin to get violence, you get civil war. And at some point you begin to realize that your unwillingness to use your intelligence wisely is destructive in the sense that sperm counts are like half of what they were in 1970. You know, why? Is it plastics or other chemicals in the environment? But is that smart? I mean, even if you look at this solely in terms of reproductive success, we're a species that is self-destructive. And so if we keep thinking of it, you know, when the pandemic was at its height, what were people worried about? They were worried, well, how can I take the ACT or the SAT? I mean, like, is that, you know, like the world
point.
Is falling apart and we're worried about, where's my testing center? This is the wrong way to go. This is just not where you want to be.
Well, I'm so glad that you wrote this book, Adaptive Intelligence, and I really hope people will read it. The subtitle is Surviving and Thriving in Times of Uncertainty. Boy, are we in times of uncertainty. So
yeah,
these are the times to buy the book, for sure. Yeah. I have to end this by thanking you for you're a huge, huge part of the reason why I'm in this field, perhaps the biggest part of the reason. You know, when I was sitting there sophomore year of college reading a cognitive psychology textbook and got to the intelligence chapter, I was like, who wrote this? This is amazing. And I see Robert Sternberg, Yale. My whole dream in life was to work with Robert Sternberg, Yale, and study intelligence. And I just have to thank you so much for what you've done to inspire me in my field. And I know a lot of other people in the field. So
well,
thank you.
I mean, it's great to have students who have done better than you have. So I'm very proud and honored to have had you as a student. And to, you know, the best thing that can happen to you is your students do better than you, just like your kids. You know, you want your kids to do better than you have. And I'm delighted you have. And I hope that, you know, you continue to have the terrific success that you've had up to now.
Thanks, Bob. And thanks for being on the Psychology Podcast.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too.
Take care. See you soon. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Also, if you'd prefer a completely ad-free experience, you can join us at patreon.com/psychpodcast. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show. And tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
Stamps.com.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
You wouldn't expect to hear that we're America's third best city for beer like this one. Or home to vibes like this. And this. It might surprise you that we're top 10 for immersive art that's like,
whoa.
And, not to mention, we have one of the top zoos in the country. So can a city with the country's best pro soccer team, ranking as a top culinary destination in the world, be in your own backyard? Yes, Columbus. Plan your summer at experiencecolumbus.com/summer.